it's not the critic who matters most. It's the men and women who are actually in the arena, whose face is marred with blood and sweat and maybe even tears a little bit. Today I am here with a couple of guys, a couple entrepreneurs, right? These are guys that are in the arena. People that are very familiar with what it's like to build a business while simultaneously going out and figuring out how to raise money, how to get some investment capital to fuel the growth. So I think as we talk to Jared Story and Anthony Romano about their businesses today, I think we're going to learn a little bit about like what it's really like in the arena, maybe demystify. I think there's a lot of people out there that are wondering, how does it actually work, right? What's it like when you're actually in the fight? And so we'll demystify that a lot, because you can't learn that in a textbook a lot of times until you go out there and get yourself punched in the face a little bit. And I think today, I want to hear from you guys the sort of the truth. How do you build a business while simultaneously going out and raising capital and really motivating a team and all the other things that you got to do? So today it's Jared Story. He's the CEO of ParsePay. It's a point of sale platform, and I happen to be lucky enough to be an investor into this company, and you guys have raised a significant amount of money, just wrapped up your seed round. And then we also have Anthony Romano. He's the CEO of eScreen Logic, and you guys have just, I think you guys are in the middle of a round right now, I think, Anthony, and you've had some experience in the past raising money and building companies, so we're gonna, and you're at a little bit different stage, I guess, as a company than what ParsePay is, so we'll kind of figure out like what it's like if you're doing a Series A, like you are, Anthony, and what it's like when you're doing the seed investment or the initial rounds. So maybe we'll contrast that a little bit, but I want you guys, no holds barred today, is that fair enough?
Fair enough.
Good.
Okay.
We're
all right.
Ready.
Good. I'll start with you, Jared, because I mean you just wrapped up your raise, and well, first of all, give us an overview of the company. Why don't we get a little bit of you, an overview of the company, and maybe a little bit of your background?
Sure. So we've been building ParsePay for 2.5 years now. So started off because one of our business partners had been in the bar and restaurant space for going on 15 years, so he's an owner-operator. He's on his fifth location, and he really is the one that saw the need in the industry and kind of got my partners and I involved in the vision, and we set off to change the way that technology can help owner-operators and just make it easy for them to know who their customers are better.
Okay, so you were just solving what problem?
We are solving the problem of payments for merchants. So there's payments that happen through apps these days. There's payments that happen through websites. There's payments that happen in location. And all of these are normally different companies. And so our platform allows customers to pay however they want to pay. And it gives the owner the full data perspective of their customer, okay, no matter how they interact.
Okay, so that allows them to know their customer better and then potentially retarget them or something?
Most definitely.
Okay.
Get them back, right?
No, gotcha.
Know their finite details.
Okay, gotcha. Okay, so Anthony, you've built you're building a different type of business. Maybe give us a little your background and what the business is.
Yeah, good. So the last 15 years I've been involved in the real estate finance kind of industry in some capacity. Was at First American as a chief revenue officer, was an executive at a company called CoreLogic. Both of those businesses been around, focus a lot on the residential mortgage marketplace and the capital markets. eScreen Logic, the role of CEO that I took 1 year ago, is just the adjacent business. So it focuses on commercial lending. And we provide commercial real estate due diligence. And what does that mean? If you're a lender, you're a bank, you're a credit union, and you're going to put out multi-millions of dollars in a commercial loan transaction, there's information that you need in order to make a good underwriting decision, particularly as it relates to the property or collateral. So things like valuations and appraisals and environmental mm-hmm. assessments and inspections. We have a platform that allows lenders to come order status, get delivery, and archive all of that information to improve their borrower's experience.
Okay. Yeah. And so let's talk about, the subject of today's show. I want to make sure we spend a little bit of time helping people understand what the process is. How do you go out and raise money? What happens real world, right? And not textbook. What actually happens? And then really kind of get into maybe the emotions involved with that. Jared, can you start us off? Okay, you went through a raise recently. Walk us through this seed round. And was that your first round of capital, or were you raising money prior?
So this was our first round of capital. So
okay.
Big learning experience, big learning curve. So one of the things that I ran into was you do a lot of research online to try to, you know, grasp what you're about ready to do. And a lot of the things that you read out there come from places like San Francisco or the Bay Area or New York or LA, these places where it's just, it's a different environment to raise.
Different than the Sacramento region.
Different than the Sacramento region. And then they have just a lot of larger investors out there. And so you read a lot online, hey, go out there. Put together a pitch deck, go start talking to VCs, you know, try to figure out if they're interested in your type of product or not. Mm-hmm. And you should be able to raise a round and close it within 6 months. You know, you're going to raise $1 million, $2 million within 6 months.
That's what
right?
the books say?
That's what the internet says, right?
The internet.
And so we learned pretty quickly that when you're raising a seed round, that's just not the case. And so sorting out what's real versus what's not real was difficult at first. And I fell back to more of my sales 101 mentality of developing relationships with people and really honing in on those key relationships, finding people that would be strategic investors, and then really getting to know those people and then having them start to help me, you know, develop relationships with other investors that they knew that they might be interested in. So the process took a whole lot longer than what the internet told me.
How long did it take?
It took a little over a year.
And how much money did you raise?
We raised $820,000.
Okay, wow. And you guys are a early stage company. You've only been around 2.5 years, and you raise, and then you're considering that your seed round.
That's correct.
Okay. And you said you started off at the VC level, right? So you initially decided to go out and meet the people that are actually venture capital companies?
Right. So when we started off, that's what you hear, right? VC, VC, VC. And so we started doing some research and quickly learned that we were looking for angel investors, not VCs, right? So you got
to
know.
How long did it take you to learn that?
Probably about a week. But yeah, pretty quickly. When a VC was just like, we're not interested.
What about the angel investors in the Bay Area? So if you're looking at Bay Area money, did you attack the angel investor market in the Bay Area, or did you focus here in the Sacramento region?
We did branch out from the Sacramento region, but we tried to focus on the Sacramento region at first, just because we do have a lot of contacts and connections here, and good strategic partners that we've developed. And so it was very nice to have the camaraderie of the angel investment community around Sacramento first, and that's really what got us going and got us some traction early on. And then we did start to branch out to other places such as San Francisco, North Bay, Tahoe, even as far up as Redding, Northern California.
Well, I look forward to, I'm going to bounce it over to Anthony here, but I look forward to, it took you a year plus to raise the money. In a week, you knew that you weren't going after the VC market, you're actually going after angel investors. So I want to, we'll spend a little more, I'm going to bounce back to you to learn a little bit more about what are the obstacles you ran into, because it does sound like you were expecting 6 months, and, you know, over a year is a long time when you're trying to, when you probably really, really need the money.
Most
so,
definitely.
Yeah. Okay, so Anthony, did you run a process? How you come in, walk us through you coming in, because you didn't help launch the company. You came in at a little bit later stage.
True, yeah. The business had been around almost 4 years, so okay. It wasn't, I think that was one of the advantages. It wasn't a back-of-the-napkin startup. There was 40-some-odd people. There was a couple $100,000 a month in run rate. So it was an existing business, burning cash, but existing business nonetheless. I came in, I think like any good CEOs can come in with a 30, 60, 90 day real clear plan of what I wanted to do. And by lunch on the first day, that was all out the window.
The first day you knew.
Day one. So it was, it was really a function of, understanding what we want to do from a strategy and business plan perspective and recognizing that the capital didn't exist to do that. So you might be able to keep the trains running on time barely, but in order to launch and grow the company and take advantage of the market, it's a gigantic marketplace, you needed capital. So I started almost immediately on a Series A. We originally thought it was going to be a convertible note. Actually raised a little bit of money, the first $750,000 under that note, and it transitioned into a priced round led by Lakesh and the guys at Moneta Ventures, mm-hmm. great group.
Why don't you explain the difference between that? So it started off as a convertible note, and then it became a priced round. What does that mean?
Yeah, from a note perspective, we were looking for a quick cash infusion. You can do that without, really having to come up with a valuation of the company. You provide some warrants and a kind of a bridge into the formal round, knowing that you were going to do that. But it got us some capital pretty quickly.
Right.
It's a way to raise money without having to decide what the value of your company is.
Very much so.
Okay.
Very much so.
Okay, so you decided to do a priced round, so people actually bought in equity. They bought equity.
Yeah, it was really, again, the gang at Moneta, who I can't say enough about. Just those are entrepreneurs that learned how to be VC, so they can come alongside and be really, really, really great in providing stewardship. They said, we'll price the round. We'll give you a value, a pre-money and a post-money valuation. We'll agree to, half of an investment now, half an investment after some milestones, and then we'll help you kind of go raise the rest. And they were great about pointing us in the right direction. I'll tell you, I had 85 different meetings, 50 different, real pitch presentations. And to Jared's point, I look at it as you got high net worth individuals, you got angel groups, you got venture capitalists, and then you got real private equity guys. And to this day, we were $2.7 million we've raised. Mm. We're actually extending the time of the round, the close, and we're increasing the round because all of those categories still have some semblance of interest. And it's funny, you hear, a private equity firm, that's exactly what you go with. Their terms are different. The amount of money they want to invest is a much larger amount, changes the dilution pretty dramatically. So there's just more to consider than just, going out pitching and collecting checks.
So the lead investor did not want to take the whole round. Sometimes companies are super hot, right? And the lead investor is sort of known, especially at the Series A level, they're sort of known for wanting to get as much equity as they can. What happened in the case of Moneta? They only wanted to come in for part of it, and then that required you to, made you want to decide, hey, let's go get some more from some angels.
And both angels and individuals, and I think there's 20 different, either individuals or groups that have, written checks from $25,000 to $500,000. But Moneta came in for a third of the what was originally the $3 million. I think they love this team. I think they, I've spent some time with them in the past. A couple other folks here, they've got a great confidence in. They were in a business that looked a lot like this in terms of how to grow, but they don't know this space as well. And so I think they wanted to kind of see how we do. And it was been such a protracted process that you wind up pushing some of your milestones and what you thought you were going to get to out, 3, 4, and 5 months because the raise didn't happen when you thought. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the challenge. That's part of the distraction.
Interesting situation here because I'm wondering the decision to come up with a priced round. What's the rationale for how you price this this offering?
Yeah, I think Lakesh looked at what we were doing with the note originally, and while he did, he said, "Look, I understand where you're going with the valuation. We'll accept it, but of course, this Series A preferred round comes with rights and preferences, so liquidation preferences and drag along rights and things of that nature that make it pretty attractive. So if you think about it, the business was valued at a $9.5 million pre-money valuation. The Series A at $3 million has a 1x liquidation preference. That means every man, woman, and child that puts money into that round gets paid before anybody else participates ratably. So you essentially got to sell the company for $3 million for everybody to get their money back. That was pretty conservative. Mm-hmm. People felt pretty safe with that regard, right? We want to go build a company we can sell for $100 million. But he ultimately decided on the valuation and price in the round and all the rights, and he built the term sheet.
Okay. Yeah. And how about you, Jared? A couple of questions. How did you choose which investor? Did you have a lead investor? And if so, how did you choose that? And also, how did you end up deciding how to value it?
Yeah, that's a great question. So yes, we had a lead investor, Kintalo of Sac Angels, which I can't stress enough. When you get started, you need to have good mentors around you. And he's really the one who kind of guided us and showed us the ropes on how to get started into actually getting checks, right? And so, you know, Ken was instrumental in us being able to be prepared to go and actually pitch large angel groups such as Sac Angels and Sierra Angels, Shasta Angels, Band of Angels. So we've pitched a bunch of angel groups now, but really it was all because of the advice, you know, that we got from our mentors, right? So having the right people around you is just utterly important, crucial. As far as the pricing, it's kind of difficult when you don't have a product that's actually in the market generating revenue. And so you hire an independent company to do an independent valuation. So we hired a company out of the Bay Area that does software valuations for startups. And that's really what gave us our first valuation on the company. We did raise on a convertible note, though, for our seed round, so it was not priced at that point.
But what about the terms of the note? How did you decide some of that stuff, what the valuation cap is and so on?
Yeah, so lots of research and then, again, relying on your mentor. So among Ken and various others that we have on our board or our advisory committee at this point, we really leaned on the advice of people that have been there and done that. And so looking at our own research and then combining it with what people that are smarter than us that have been there and done that before, we're telling us, that's kind of where we kind of settled on our conclusions about where we should be.
So in the convertible note, you care if we get into terms of your deal? Is that,
No, not at all.
You said nothing's off limits. So I have all kinds of questions up my sleeve. So, remind me, cause I'm invested into both of your companies, but I don't remember the terms very well. So you're a convertible note and there's a, there's probably a discount rate and so on. How did that arrive?
Yeah, so we set a 20% discount and 10% interest on the note, and then it's a $4 million cap.
Okay. Is that kind of industry standard for a small software company?
It's fairly standard
for
software.
That sounds about
software.
Normal for what I see.
Yeah, and it's actually a little bit better. We wanted to get traction quickly with the investment community. We had people that were ready to go on the team that we knew were going to be a great fit to help us get to the next level. So we wanted to start raising money as quickly as possible so we can bring on the right team members to help us really grow. And so for us, it was about making sure that we were able to start raising money quickly as opposed to waiting 6 months for the first check to roll in. So that's kind of where we decided at that point.
So there's a lot of terminology. We're throwing around terminology, interest rate, discount, all this stuff. Some of this stuff is foreign language to people who have never raised money before. What was the learning curve like for you as you had to deal with all these acronyms?
Yeah, so big learning curve. I mean, there's a lot to know about the pricing and what you're setting up for your actual convertible note and things like that. Very fortunate to have an attorney on my board of advisors that is the CEO of his own startup, a technology startup, and he's actually sold two companies previously as well. And so...
And who is that?
Terry Carlone.
Okay.
Yeah, part of Sac Angels as well. So I probably talk to him at least once a week still.
Interesting.
So when you have people like that in your corner that have been there and done that, like I said, you don't have to be the smartest guy in the room.
You don't have to pay an attorney. You have he doesn't bill you back for that.
No,
he does not. That's a good idea. Get an attorney to invest in your company and get some free legal advice. Because I mean, Anthony, the attorney fees can stack up when you do these type of things. I mean, how do you deal with attorney's fees?
Yeah, it's interesting because the company had been operating for some time, and this isn't unique, right? You, as a small business, you don't necessarily dot all the I's and cross all the T's as you're funding the business yourself. Mm-hmm. And so I go back into 2016, 17, and 18 as this company was running. It was multiple contributed assets for multiple companies that created eScreen Logic. And long story short, as we started the due diligence with Moneta, the expectation was we would spend, you know, $20,000 to $30,000 in legal fees.
Okay.
And the process would take 30 days. 120 days later, and $155,000 later, we were done with the due diligence. And I say that only because
done with the due diligence.
When you think about the legal, financial, business diligence that's done, it uncovers all the potential chinks in the armor. This schedule wasn't filed right. This document was never done right. These things weren't incorporated right. These certificates were never done. So the company, essentially, we had to redo everything, right? Right. You almost created a new entity. Again, Moneta, I give them tons of credit. They stuck with us through that process. It was painful for both sides. It was way more expensive, but now you've got a pristine business that, as you want to, you know, go into the future and have some kind of an exit, you don't have, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars to clean up.
Yeah. It demonstrates, yeah, the need for getting the big decisions right at the beginning.
I think, you know, in a company like Jared, you know, the corporate governance is in place now, right? You're doing it right from the start. You know, this business just had a bunch of stuff in the background that needed to be cleaned. Moneta is an SBIC fund, right? They've got banks in their fund, and you got to do it right. So nobody's going to, you know, let you get a pass on things that aren't filed and done right.
So thinking about the emotion and coming in here, you're coming in essentially as almost like a turnaround artist. I would have to assume, because you're coming in as the new CEO. The founder is no longer the CEO. You come in new hired gun to grow this thing. Obviously you've got a ton of experience, but I mean, what was the reception like when you came in from the employees? Cause you guys have a lot of employees.
Yeah. And today now there's over 50, I think it's 55 employees. There was 40 some odd when I got there. It was incredible reception. And it was more of the founders, you know, that they were cheering this whole thing on, right? They handpicked this in their eyes. And I would even say in mine, it wasn't quite a turnaround. It was just, let's take this business to the next level. This is $1.5 billion to $2 billion market. It's a big market to go disrupt and bring some efficiencies to. So we were excited to get after it in that regard and build a strategy to go do that. So that integration into the team, very easy for me.
Okay.
To do.
So what was the biggest stress then? If the cost was more than expected, the time was more than expected, what kept you up at night? What keeps you up at night today?
Yeah, I mean, I still think this you would say fundraising is a complete distraction for the CEO. CEO ought to be setting culture and strategy, and more importantly, ought to be out evangelizing out in front of the customer and business partners to grow the business. When you're talking about 60 and 70% of your time on fundraising and follow-ups and presentations and pro formas and all the like, it's a big distraction. It keeps you from getting traction in the areas of the business that drive growth and hit milestones. So that's the biggest the challenge, I think, from a fundraising perspective, is you want to be out in the mix with your business partners and your clients growing the company. And it's hard to do that simultaneously when you're doing a lot of fundraising.
You bet. Well, I can imagine you only get one chance to make a first impression with your employees, with your customers, with suppliers and so on. So when you're day one having to put 70% of your time into fundraising, it's harder to go out there and make a big splash. Hey, Anthony Romano is on the team now. Yeah. Here's how we're going to go kick some butt and change the world together. Yeah. You're spending your time in meetings and dating potential, you know, suitors and so on.
Yeah, we did a good job. I think the leadership team I have alongside me is stellar. Just an extraordinary team with great experience of all played this game before. And even the employee base, they get it. They understand that there's, you know, that the capital is required to grow and to move to the next level. And so, I've been blessed. They've been great as a team. We've gotten by this and we're really close.
Well, okay. So you have a bunch of Sac State alum on the team, because we did the deal over at the Carlson Center at Sac State and your whole table was filled with Sac State. Is there one person that stood out? It's like, I couldn't have done it without him or her.
Yeah, I mean, you said it. So founder Craig Clark, Sac State grad. I'm a Sac State grad. Toby Lutz, who's our chief administration officer, Sac State grad. Mark Hockridge, who I co-founded Customer Link with, Sac State grad. And our CFO, who ultimately got his MBA at USC, but started as a Sac State grad. So that whole team together, couldn't have done it without any of them, frankly. And everybody's kind of got their 9 square feet of the world that they're running on. We were running a play together. But they've been incredibly cooperative and helpful and supportive and, you know, taking stuff off my plate so that I can go get this done.
And they work together really well as a team.
Really well, right?
Okay.
That's the coolest thing. The team's gelling, the employee base is gelling, everybody's rallying, and Yeah, we're going to build a wildly successful company here. We just got to get this fundraising.
Interesting to think about the stress. Well, okay, so emotion, you're in an earlier stage. Talk to us about the emotion that you felt as you were building the team and also having to deal with this fundraising.
Yeah, it's extremely stressful. I remember, at one point in the beginning of January, felt like I was on the verge of a mental breakdown, and never encountered anything like that before in my life. Very stable person or whatever. But you're worried about the people that you have around you and their families, right? And taking care of them. And it's a lot of stress to have on you as a person. But we were at the point there in January where we had $10,000 in the bank account. And if I didn't get another check in January, then my partners weren't going to feed their families, right? So when you put it in perspective, yeah, it's heavy stuff, but you got to dig really deep inside of you and just go and do it. You got to make it happen. So I'll speak to the same thing Anthony spoke to about having the right people around you on your founding team. They're the ones who enabled me to, you know, go out there and really build the relationships and facilitate what I needed to do on the interaction side to bring those checks in and not have to worry about so much of the business operation at that time, because I knew that they can handle it. So we developed a really structured system where Mondays and Fridays it was founding team meetings and making sure that communication was good and so everybody knew what each other was doing and we were all moving in the right direction. And they knew Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday that I was going to be out grinding, doing what I needed to do to make it happen for the team.
And the pressure was on you because you had to go raise the money. The customer money wasn't coming in because you guys were making sales by that point.
We had a few customers at that point, but I mean, you're talking minimal amounts of revenue at that point.
You weren't putting the pressure back on them to go sell something?
Well, so I have a CTO and a CMO, and then our Brandon Blankenship, our CXO. So we do have a core group of people, but at that time, the product wasn't really ready to go to market. We were still testing it. We were still in beta and weren't quite ready to come out of beta yet. So we've since done that, and that's relieved some pressure, yes. Obviously. But at that time, that was the moment that the rubber met the road, or I had to meet the road. You know, you got to tell yourself that you believe in what you're doing and go out there and just make it happen.
Well, the compensation of the founding team, how do you decide on that kind of stuff? Because if people can barely feed their family, they're obviously taking in the minimalist that they can, I guess, live on.
Yeah. I mean, that's really important to communicate, I think, up front before, you know, you get into all of this with the business partner. You got to know who your business partners are. And I've known my business partners for more than 10 years now at this point. And so I know that they're not in it for the money. They're in it for the long-term vision. We're all rowing in the same direction. And so still to this day, we take the minimum amount. Because we really want to put those resources back into growing the company. And so when you know that that's the mentality of your team, then you don't really have to worry about that too much.
And as an investor, those are the kinds of things that we look for. To me, the number one core value that as an investor that I look for in a CEO and a founding team is the commitment level. And I think when people are so in that it's not about the salary, because I feel like that's a big red flag is when people start, everybody needs to make six figures right off the bat, and they don't really have, I guess, the skin in the game. That's
right.
One of the ways I measure how committed people are.
Right. No, I totally agree with that. And if my business partners had the opposite mentality, I probably wouldn't be business partners with them.
Interesting. How about you on that front in terms of commitment level when your company, Anthony, was growing and doing what it needed to do, and then they bring you in. Was comp a factor? Were people having to really squeeze it because you were potentially going to run out of money?
Yeah, I mean, I think the entire leadership team works well below market, right? These are folks that could have went out and got two and three and four times the amount of money that we're willing to pay them right now, that we're able to. But to Jared's point, I think this whole team sees the vision of where we're trying to go over the next 3, 5, 7 years and what we're trying to do. So you participate from a compensation standpoint in other ways through equity and things of that nature. But yeah, the commitment, that's a big pucker factor. I mean, right, you know, I took a $600,000 pay cut and put $400,000 of my own money in the company. Wow. So, and that was in the first few months I was there. So it, that tells a lot to the investor. I think the, you know, that for Moneta, that was a big deal. You know, but the other side of the pressure, and you talk about, I'm certain that, you know, Kleiner Perkins comes and drops $20 million in a company. There's a lot of pressure on the CEO and the leaders, but you go out and talk to all your derelict buddies and they write $50,000 and $100,000 checks into your company. That's more pressure, okay, right? These are guys that you're looking at who sit across the table from you and said, I believe in you. And here's 200 and here's 100 and here's 50. That just ups the ante. In my mind.
Yeah, guys that are doing it with their own money, right? I'm taking it out of my retirement. That's maybe true. I'm worth 5, 10, 20, who knows, 100 million, whatever it is. Someone puts $50,000 into your company, you feel, I mean, success is not an option.
It's a light level of obligation. I think we talk about that. It's funny. If you saw the movie Free Solo with Alex Honnold, right? Uh-huh. I saw it four days in a row, four times. And I mean, this guy climbs 3,000 feet up El Cap with no ropes. And that's what we've said we're doing right now. We're not the recklessness, arrogant bravado, but like, we're not going to fail. We talk, you know, the last 12 months we've been sitting around, there's no discussion of, hey, what's plan B? Because it doesn't exist. Yeah. We're going to make it.
So I love the idea that you're both very committed to your teammates. You love your team. Then you got to go home, though. So you talked about, Jared, you talked about nervous breakdown or however you phrase this, it being so stressful that, you know, it was really at a tipping point practically. Then you got to go home and you've got a family and so on. I mean, the life balance piece of somebody who is up against the wall to protect their investors, to protect their teammates, to come together. I mean, and then you come home and you're supposed to be positive with your support system as well at home. Like, hey, we got this, right? You got to exude confidence. What'd you do?
Oh man, it's important to strike a balance and maintain your routines at the same time. So I'm a creature of habit. So making sure that you know, you make enough time for I have a little one. So I have a 4.5-year-old daughter, right? And so showing up to her, you know, her school play, or making sure that when she's got a holiday lunch, you know, you pop in there for half an hour and spend that time where you can. Super important. And then you got to have that support system at home too, right? You got to have somebody at home that you can share your worst fears with, right? And that person's got to be supportive and understanding of that. But you also have to make sure that you're doing the same thing for them, because it can't always be, you know, all about you, right? So striking that balance is ultra important, because if you're not happy at home, it's hard to be, you know, out there grinding and loving what you do out there on the flip side of things too. So the other thing that I really tried to hone in on was my own personal process of mental preparation. So I talk about being a creature of habit. So every morning I go to the gym and I start my day at the gym, just, you know, working out and working out anxiety, right? And trying to make sure that when I get to work, I'm fully awake, I'm fully ready, I'm fully motivated to go and attack that day. So the routine and getting into that routine and making sure that was set in stone was really important.
Tell me about that person that was in your corner.
Yeah,
at home.
Well, at home, so, you know, your spouse, right? Your wife. So my wife, Joyce, was a cornerstone for me. There's lots of nights where you're preparing for a pitch, let's say. So I'm not a professional public speaker, right? I had to go and learn how to, you know, pitch a large group of investors. And so, you know, some nights you're not going to bed with your significant other, and they got to understand that, because I was out in the garage practicing my pitch all night, right? Making sure that I had it 100% dialed in, because the next day I was going to be pitching Band of Angels in San Francisco, right? And so that person has to be your cornerstone, your rock, super understanding, and she allowed me the flexibility to do that, right? Taking care of our 4.5-year-old when I couldn't do that, and I had to, you know, do this, that, or the other. So striking a balance with one another and keeping the communication, you know, tight with her was really important throughout this entire process too.
Anthony, how did you deal with the work-life balance, to keep it simple?
A little different situation than that. I have a daughter who just graduated from University of Arizona.
Congratulations.
Ernst & Young in the city, and another daughter is a sophomore in college. So it's a little different time in my life. And I'm sort of thankful for that, the freedom to do that. But you know, Jared's absolutely right. You better have somebody squarely in your corner in terms of a spouse that can help not only support you and encourage you, but help to make you unencumbered. And I'm fortunate. My wife and I have been together since I was 15 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So it's been a long success.
How long have you been married? I guess we're going to get your age too.
Married in 94, but
wow.
I took her to the homecoming dance in high school as a sophomore and been dating ever since.
Wow.
So super blessed in that regard. Her name's Wendy. She's been amazingly supportive. But she's also recognized, you know, she's like, hey, you're working like 70 hours a week, and not like thinking about work, but you're working. And I said, yeah, well, there's 168 hours in the week, so I got like 98 for you. Not the problem. So,
keep her happy in those hours.
She recognizes that you're going to be consciously, it's almost like when you have a baby, you're going to be consciously out of balance for a little while. You just got to get comfortable being you're not going to spend as much time doing all the things you otherwise wanted to do. And I think Jared's right on those personal practices of hitting the gym, of doing sauna, of doing cold therapy, of doing meditation, of doing prayer, whatever your routines are, you got to do those so you can do this job well. So I don't have a lot of this year fitness goals and workout goals. It's doing all that right so I can do this job well.
Mm-hmm.
And that's important.
It's interesting because we can only sprint. Some people say it's a marathon. Other people say it's a sprint. And I've always felt like it's probably something in between, almost like a series of sprints, entrepreneurship in general, right? You have these first impression opportunities, like when you first come into a company or you're launching a company, and then there's these other windows. But if you can't sprint for 20 years, can you? That's my opinion. So how would you respond to that?
No, I think you're absolutely right. And I think, when I talk to some of my, you know, best friends that I've worked with for years and that were, you know, really honest with me, they say, you're an incredible sprinter, but you then you'll check out. Like when I look at my routine, and so I've had to be really good self-awareness around this, that I can run really hard for a period of weeks, and then you've got to let off the gas, or it's not sustainable,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you got to know kind of
intervals.
Yeah. I got to have personal discipline around that. But, when it's crunch time and you know, payroll requires it, you got to keep sprinting.
Are you still sprinting? I mean, you're done with your raise, Jared. Were you able to do some hang time, as I like to call it?
Yeah, thankfully, we finished our round mid-November. It was right in time for the holidays. So we did get a little bit of a break for Christmas. But, I mean, you're talking 2-3 days off, and then you're right back to it. So, again, we're starting to sprint right now, again, because we're preparing for the next raise. So we have goals and milestones for monthly recurring revenue that we need to get to now. So we're sprinting to those goals because the end result of that is going to, you know, be the catalyst to raising your Series A. We're currently sprinting again. So got a little bit of a breather, but
you did. What did you do so help the rest of us. A lot of entrepreneurs have trouble turning it off. Like, what do you do to forget about work for a second?
Yeah, I think that for me personally, it's just focusing on family.
Yeah.
So on the holidays this year, I didn't have to do any traveling. I had a brother fly in that I hadn't seen in like a year and a half. So he's all over the world. He's in the military flying helicopters, so he's always somewhere.
Oh, wow.
And so got to see him for a long
period. What branch of the service is he in?
He's in the Army.
Okay, flying helicopters.
Flies Blackhawks.
Wow.
Yeah.
Who's got the more difficult job?
Oh, man. Yeah, that's debatable. But he's definitely got the more difficult job. Nobody's shooting at me, so yeah.
Yikes. That's got to be stress on you, too, as the brother. I mean, my kid's been deployed, had people shooting at it. He got shot. But, I mean, it's scary as a parent, but as a brother, too. Your brother's in harm's way, and you're trying to live life here.
Most definitely. I look at him, he's an older brother. He's never lived life with any kind of fear, which is why he does what he does, right? Mm-hmm. So I look at him as an example of how to go and lead, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because also in our role, you can have fear, but you can't you know, go and project fear. You can't show your team that you're fearful. You have to be confident, and you have to know exactly what the game plan is and push forward and motivate your team, right? And so, you know, he's actually somebody that drives me to be better.
Hmm. Is there somebody, okay, do you have a role model by any chance, Anthony? Is there anybody that you look up to and go, you know, that's someone who drives me?
You know, I think I've had a lot of role models in this process the last year. A lot of them have come back out of the woodwork who are just really good, solid friends who've been mentors over the year. First guy I ever worked for in IBM was a guy named Dave Sanders.
Yes.
I was 18 years old, and Dave's been around, and I know Jared's been involved with him as well.
Is he invested into ParsePay?
So through SAC Angels.
Sorry to interrupt you.
That's all right.
Oh, through SAC Angels. Yeah, okay.
But he's on my advisory board.
Okay.
So I know him pretty well.
Yeah. He's awesome. Okay.
Dave knows that space pretty well.
Yeah.
I think about folks like Roger Akers, who was a big investor in the first company I had, who's, you know, provided us so much stewardship and taught us resolve and how to get through stuff. And you know, that's been great. So, yeah.
There's always somebody. So thinking about, you know, dealing with this situation, or anything you would have done differently? I mean, maybe we'll start with Jared. You know, you said you would have started a week earlier on the going after angel investors. But I mean, what else would you go back and go, are there things now where you're sort of like kicking yourself, like maybe something that you want to stop somebody else from having to do?
Yeah, I think that we made a lot of communication errors in the beginning. Right, so for the first 3 months, we were really trying to figure it out. So we started fundraising in October, and I think that we got our first check beginning of January. And it was just because, you know, we just didn't know what we didn't know at that point, right? We were bringing on advisors to help us through that process and getting things really lined up to go and be appealing to an investor, right? And so, you know, really diving a little bit deeper into the process and the research in the beginning, I think would have been helpful. For my particular team, though, I think that the communication and really honing in on the processes that we put in place later, really dialing those in the beginning would have been helpful, too, because, you know, when you go 3 months without bringing in a check and your team's relying on you to go out there and do that, and they're looking at you like, well, you know, we did all this research and everything that we see online says that, you know, we should be already have our first million in the bank and blah, blah, blah. Well, that's just not true, right? And so the communication amongst the team and really letting them know what my process and my organization for going out there and getting it done so that they, you know, knew and trusted and believed in me to go and execute for the team would have been helpful for me in the beginning too.
Well, you said you put on your sales hat earlier when you went out to fundraise. It became a relationship building process. How long is the sales cycle? I mean, after you give a pitch, walk me through that. So you do a pitch. Did they write a check the next day? Does it? What's average? Or what? You know, give us the 411 on that.
Yeah, most definitely. I think it's different for every investor. To be quite honest with you, we had some investors that it took one meeting, and we had some investors that it took six meetings. Right. So depending on the comfort level of the investor. So one thing to know is that no means no until it means yes. Right. So if somebody tells you no, it doesn't mean that they're not going to invest in you. It means that you haven't given them enough information, or you haven't built a good enough relationship with them yet. And so you need to take a different approach, and you need to figure out why they're telling you no. And so we ran into a couple of investors that told us no in the beginning and then ended up investing in us 6 months later.
Why did they say no at the beginning?
They just didn't know enough about us, I think, at that time, right?
So what do they say? Do they say no, or do they say, hey, I was just going to follow you, or not now? How do they phrase it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that they try to be polite and tell you not now. Nobody just blatantly said
nobody
no,
says, I, or, your pitch sucked,
yeah,
dude.
Yeah, you stink, like, whatever. So you don't have to be fearful of that. But I think that what you have to do is really circle back and identify. Try to get feedback from that person, right? So get their feedback as to why they're telling you no. One thing that I heard over and over again is that are from a bunch of different investors is they would never hear from a entrepreneur again once they were told no, mm-hmm. right? And so I tried to take the exact opposite approach to that and really get to know the investor after they said, oh, yeah, you know, at a later time, we're not ready yet, or, you know, you're not to the point where I would invest in you yet. And really circle back to that person and show them that you're you know, really interested in trying to connect with that person and really trying to understand why they're saying what they're saying. And then, you know, through that process of communication back and forth, then you can have deeper discussions about your business and what your vision is. Because a lot of these pitches, I mean, let's face it, they're 15 minutes, right? You're pitching your business in 15 minutes and somebody's trying to make a judgment of whether or not it's worth it to them or not. But that's really not enough time to understand what you're actually trying to do a lot of times. So you got to get deeper.
Did you pitch individuals or just through angel groups?
We did both.
How did you uncover the individuals? Where are these angel investors hiding?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So I did a lot of research online. So there's various websites out there like angel.co and... there's Gust, which right. is, you know, shows you all the angel groups around the area. There was another website, I can't remember off the top of my head, but if you just Google search database of like angel investors
yeah.
or angel lists, yeah. So, but you want to try to find people that are actually interested in your type of product also, right? So you have to find the right fit, and you also have to find the right, you know, you have to find the right stage of investor. For us, it was angels, right? And so doing a lot of research like that, I literally compiled a list of 60 people just in the local area that I thought would be a good fit. And I methodically went through and talked to all of those people and followed up with them diligently.
You just call them on the phone or you show up at their office? How do you do that?
No, you try to make connections through connections, right? So if you're going to go and do cold outreach, you're going to have maybe a 20, 30% chance of getting a hold of somebody and them actually being interested in talking to you. You try to use and leverage connections where you can to get introductions to other people.
Anthony, how long is your is what happened with your process similar to what you hear with Jared? How might it have differed?
Yeah, similar in some regard. I think the investment thesis of the group you're talking to is a big deal. We went after a couple of VCs that we weren't in their wheelhouse, right? They were looking for unicorn type, you know, 10 times exit of top line revenue, and it wasn't middle market fintech prop tech like we're in. So, I mean, understanding the investment thesis of the PE or the VC firm that you're working with is a big deal. And I mean, I think in hindsight. People talk about pro formas, and I've seen a lot, and most of them are amateur formas. They're not pro formas. they are based on, you know, Q4 times floor plus 20%. And you talked about single unit economics. If you can't, as the CEO and the leadership team, drill all the way down and be able to explain month over month and quarter over quarter what the drivers are in the business, what the levers are, what the assumptions are, what could go right and what could go wrong. That's the level of detail an investor wants to get in with you. Maybe not a friend, mm-hmm. but a venture capital company or somebody who's, you know, high net worth that does a big investment, they want to double click and really understand what could happen right and what could happen wrong. In hindsight, you know, we'd have done that a little tighter in the kind of first and second quarter of next year. I think we're in great shape now, but those are the kind of conversations we're having right now.
And so you're right in the middle of it now. So somebody, you go in and pitch and somebody gives you the, you know, let me think about it. Do you have a similar follow-up process or what's your reaction to something that feels like rejection?
Yeah, I mean, I think Jared's point was super cool. Where, you know, if somebody says no, they just don't know enough yet. Unless their thesis is completely different, but these guys are all wanting to put money into something to see it succeed and to get a return on an investment, right? And so you talk about a 7 to 10 time return on your money. Pretty conservatively in a business like this, it's pretty exciting. So either they don't like the space, they don't like the team, they don't understand the market. But I haven't had a lot of that, to be honest with you. It's been more of a protracted process than a no,
okay.
Where they just want, you know, additional information.
How long does it take on average?
Yeah, I mean, we had several that were, you know, 30 to 60 days and some that were 6 months. I mean, when the Moneta start to finish until they wrote the check because of that diligence process, that was a long process. And in the interim, you still got to raise money under the guise of those terms so you can run the business. And now we're, you know, beginning to sell your way out of that. So your burn rate gets reduced because mm-hmm. you manage your expenses and you grow your revenue. Yeah. But, Yeah, to run the play we want to run, we're still looking for $1.5 million to $2 million.
Do you find yourself having to follow up with people all the way until the wire is transferred? Is there still a lot of, like, almost not nagging, but good follow-up to get things across the finish line?
A little bit, yeah, for sure. And our team helps with that and getting all the investor documents and the stock purchase agreement and the investor rights agreements and having them sign those DocuSign and wire the funds or bring a check. And, you still do that the right way. And you take it seriously. So this is people's money. This is their investment. And so you take that very seriously.
Yeah. Now, you have a little bit smaller team. Were you the one, Jared, that was doing all the follow-up calls?
Yeah.
Were there ever times where you're like, are you going to ever send the check, dude?
Yeah, it's definitely a process, and you have to stay on top of it. And, when you think about the timing of when we raised, you got to look at seasonality as well, right? So we were raising when we started October, went through the holidays, right? And so we had interest investment interest through the holidays, but people are focused on their family in that time too. So you have to be understanding of what's going on in other people's lives as well. So I didn't pester people, but I definitely made sure that they knew that I was still there, and made sure that, until that check hit the bank account, that I was following up.
All right. So thinking about this, if you had to sort of summarize the experience that you're going through right now, and if there was a word to describe it, Anthony, is there a word that sort of describes your feeling at the moment with the business, with the fundraising effort?
Intense. I think my wife will say, you seem stressed. And I think for me, stress is you don't know what to do. You got a lot going on, you're challenged, but you don't know what to do. That's not the case here. I know exactly what to do. It's just the stakes are really high. So it's super intense, and you got to be in the game.
How about you, Jared? Is there a word that describes the way you feel today, now that much of this is behind you? I think the first piece of this is behind you.
Yeah, I would say it feels amazing. Yeah, for me, there was a lot to learn, right? This is my first time doing what I'm doing now. And so learning the process and getting through it, when you start, you're like, oh man, this is a big mountain to climb, right? And when you are kind of starting slow, you're looking at it like, I don't know, this is insurmountable. But you get into the routine and you get stuff moving and it keeps moving and building, and when you get to the backside of it, it's just an amazing feeling, because it's a huge accomplishment at the end of the day.
When are you going to go out for your next raise?
Yeah, so we're starting to put things together right now, actually.
So it's almost a full-time thing at some level. You're going to have to continue to raise. You try to get yourself how much runway?
Yeah, so we're always looking to have between 6 months to a year in the bank. And so, for us, it's about starting the process early, because we learned that the earlier the better, from the last one, right? And also, the more money you're raising, the longer the due diligence process takes, as Anthony spoke to earlier. And so we want to get out and get in front of that.
How did you think about dilution, right? So you raised $825,000. You've got multiple co-founders. Did you ever think about the dilution, or is it just, let's just go build something that changes the world?
Yeah, so we do look at dilution, most definitely. I mean, you want to try to conserve for yourself and also for your early investors where you can. You want to keep everybody's best interest in mind. And so that is definitely something that we're looking at. And so, that's a product of building, the right kind of, revenue, right now to get the right terms that we want later. And so, as we're building that right now, that's definitely something that, we're sitting down. We have a board meeting next week, actually. This is all part of the discussion, that's going to be had, with our board. So, Anthony and I were talking about different investment vehicles earlier that give you less dilution in the long run and stuff too. So you're always looking for whatever the best option is going to be for your shareholders.
Yeah, Anthony, on that thought, so how much runway are you looking to create for yourself? Is there ever a runway? Are you always raising?
I think we ideally here we'd like to complete this round and deploy the capital organically and through this distribution channel to get to a point where we're, have EBITDA, mm-hmm. Which creates a different valuation. So as you're raising money, then there's less dilution go forward. Looking at some other instruments, some venture debt and some other things that are a little less dilutive. But at the end of the day, we weren't overly concerned. I mean, it's basis points here and there. And if you do the right thing and you build the company you want, everybody wins.
Everybody's going to have a good exit or a good time along the way.
Absolutely.
Okay, so just closing thoughts, maybe each of you, just advice. So we have entrepreneurs out there that are dreaming of being where you're at. I mean, Series A for sure is a huge milestone, but just getting your business off the ground, closing a seed round, that's a major milestone for a lot of entrepreneurs. Advice to those individuals out here that are thinking, okay, I'm at the beginning stage. I want to make sure I do it correctly.
Yeah, so the number one thing that I think that myself and our team did well is to get the right mentors around you if you haven't been there and done it on your own. And I think that was a very critical step for us to take in the beginning, is to build our advisory board, right? And when you have a group of solid people that you know you can trust, the advice that they're giving you is absolutely genuine from the heart, and it comes from a place of experience, and they've been there and done that before, it makes it so much easier. So definitely build the right people around you.
Words of advice, Anthony, your business is much further along, but maybe there's people that are at Jared's level, advice and going out for the Series A and getting that.
I mean, what Jared said, I would agree with. If you're in the Sacramento region, you should come see Mark Haney and his team who know how to incubate companies. But you know, the other thing is, you better get clear. You look in the mirror, you better be damn sure this is what you want to do. And you better set your intention and then put all your attention on it. And that's how things manifest. If you're waffling or wavering, or it's a maybe, or you got a plan B and a C, that doesn't work.
Hell yeah or nah.
Yeah.
Great discussion. A lot of nuggets of information. Thank you guys for sharing your story, putting the real world out there, the men in the arena. A lot of us don't know what that's like yet until we get in. So thank you for being so transparent. Mm-hmm. Thanks for the great info. I think we all learned a lot. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks for having us.
You bet.